Hello, this is Paula Kaufman with the Journal Republican, reading stories dated August 6th through August 12th, 2020. We'll start with the article headlined, About 14% of Bement Students Choose Online Option, by Steve Hoffman, August 11th. For the 14% of Bement students who have opted to learn solely online this semester, Superintendent Sheila Greenwood is confident they will get a quality education, thanks to a contract with EduCere, E-D-U-C-E-R-E, which specializes in online curriculum for K-12 students. She told the school board, August 5th, that the software is based on Illinois software standards, has a pacing guide to track student progress, and lists what assignments have been completed and which assignments are pending. It's pretty engaging, honestly, said Greenwood. If I was going to do remote learning, I'd be pretty jacked about it, because you have videos and interaction. The online teachers provided by the company are based in Illinois, she said. Our hopes are that at the end of the first semester, that what they've learned will be transferable to the second semester, said Greenwood. Registration for the 2020-21 school year was ending just as the school board meeting began, with preliminary figures being brought in to school administrators as the meeting progressed. At that point, 39 students had opted into distance learning out of an expected student body of 290. Of that total, 11 high schoolers had opted in to fully online learning, along with 10 middle school students and 18 from the elementary school. It was noted that about 25 families had not shown up at registration, so the online figure could rise. Remote distance learning, which Greenwood referred to as the Bement Online Academy, will not be cheap for the school district. At $499.75 each, 39 licenses will run the district $19,490.25. Parents will pay $200 per student for online learning, but since they will not have registration fees, will come close to breaking even, said the superintendent. Those eligible for free and reduced lunch will pay $100 for the online option. Greenwood said those who do not contact the district will automatically be signed up for in-person instruction, which the district is also offering as an option 5 days per week, with slightly shortened days beginning August 17th. There was also plenty of discussion on the in-person learning option, along with the safety precautions being taken to protect students and staff from COVID-19. Greenwood outlined precautions being taken, including the purchase of clipboards that students can use for assignments while outdoors, lanyards for students to hold their masks when not in use, 2 30-by-60-foot tents outside to allow for socially distanced mask breaks, water bottles which can be filled at filling stations, hands-free sanitizing stations, earbuds with plastic cases for all students. She added that some stairwells will be designated one way to decrease traffic. Playgrounds are off limits, and temperature checks and wellness check questions will be administered to each student before they enter school building. Board member Trixie Sturger-Flavin liked the fact the school was going further than just temperature checks at the door. I'm glad you're going through questions at the door, said Flavin, saying it is more thorough since some may show other symptoms but not have a fever. Greenwood said social distancing in school means 6 feet whenever possible, knowing that it cannot be attained at all times. She added that it will be an adjustment for teachers to stay distant from their students. It's difficult, I think, for educators. We use proximity a lot, and we're not going to be able to do that as much, said the superintendent. Some measures are being taken to accommodate more distance, such as increasing the screen font on computers so they can be seen from far away. It's a no-win situation, acknowledged board member Kyle Rogers. Students opting into online, which they must do for an entire semester, will be allowed to participate in extracurricular activities, but must adhere to school safety policies when they do, including face coverings. Board member Lena Summers was not sure fully online learner should be allowed in extracurriculars. That bothers me, she said. I feel like if they can't come to school, why would they want to be in all those activities? Greenwood replied that the policy is based on guidance from the state and that she felt they could not be excluded. About 12% online at Blue Ridge. The Farmer City-based Blue Ridge School District had 84 of 709 students choose the online option for the first semester, which amounts to about 11.8%. Students at the 4th through 8th grade Blue Ridge Intermediate and Junior High School signed up for the online package at the highest rate, 15.6%, followed by Schneider Elementary, 10.4%, and Blue Ridge High School, 9.8%. CG Teachers School Board approved four-year agreement by Steve Hoffman, August 11th. Cerro Gordo teachers will get an average 4.98% raise this fall and 18.82% over the next 4 years under a contract approved by both the school board and Cerro Gordo Education Association on August 3rd. The four-year agreement will boost starting teacher pay to $37,668 annually when it goes into effect at the start of the 2020-21 school year, and to $41,400 by the fall of 2023-24. It has a very strong financial package, and the feeling was that the board really showed value in their teachers about being competitive with area schools in this day and age of teacher shortages, said Education Association President Frankie Martin. School Superintendent Brett Robinson said that was the idea. "We have a great teaching staff," he said. "We want them to be here, want them to come here, and be a teacher at Cerro Gordo when we have openings. And we want our veteran teachers to know they are valued and appreciated for the great job they do." Martin said the union got the message. "We had a very positive response from the membership," added Martin, noting the contract was approved by its 40 union members by an overwhelming margin. She added that the negotiations, conducted in about six sessions between late May and July 21st, was a very collaborative effort. Besides salary increases, there were minor changes in contract language, including some that open up the opportunity for more tuition reimbursement, such as in online learning. "It encourages growth, encourages continuing education and advanced degrees," said Martin, who will enter her 27th year of teaching in Cerro Gordo in 2020-21. Robinson said the school building shutdowns had little effect on the negotiation process, except for the process starting slightly later than usual and moving sessions to a larger room so the participants could social distance. "It was a good experience," said Robinson of this year's negotiations. The new agreement will replace the three-year contract that is in effect until the start of school next week. Libraries still seeing plenty of curbside customers, by Steve Hoffman, August 11th. Allerton Public Library is open for business, with limited hours and in-library browsing, but its director says most of their activity at this point is still curbside service and online activities. After telling the library board on August 5th that circulation for July was a healthy 2,527, library director Lisa Winters added, "A majority of that is curbside service. Several people are requesting curbside service. They just don't want to come in. Interlibrary loans are once again flowing, but at a slow pace." "It's very slow," said Winters in response to a question from library board member Mike Harris. "It's taking 3 to 4 weeks. Part of the reason is the disinfecting procedure taken when books are returned or go from one facility to another." Winters said Allerton quarantines books for 5 to 7 days, wiping them down before they can go back in the stacks or sent to another facility. That's longer than the 3 to 5 days in isolation that was being done due to new research that shows the COVID-19 virus can survive longer than thought on some books, especially those with glossy finishes. "What they have found is that if the pages are glossy, it's lasting 4 days," said Winters. "So we changed our time to where we're holding things back 4 to 7 days instead of just 3 to 5. The study showed the virus can last even longer on magazines, so the library has opted not to allow those to be circulated for now. And since the activity room is being used to isolate returned materials, that means a hold on hosting events in the library is still on pause." Still plenty of activity. library staff were able to provide summer activities for area children despite the COVID-19 shutdowns through remote means. The most popular of the children's events was a summer sun catcher craft, where materials were picked up outside at the library and put together from home via online instructions on July 29. The craft sessions were the most popular of the summer and included making a lion puppet, a 3D dino puzzle craft, and a 4th of July craft. Other summer programs included one from the Orpheum Museum, a presentation on one-room schoolhouses by the Museum of the Grand Prairie, and virtual bingo. In addition, a total of 150 people took part in the virtual summer reading program, which was open to adults for the first time this year. A total of 210 prizes were awarded. 5 online story times were also offered. In other action, the library board heard that June corporate personal property replacement tax receipts were close to the same month in 2019. The library district received $27,385 this year, compared to $28,418 in 2019. CPPRT is based on corporate profits, so is expected to drop as much as 25% in 2020-21 due to COVID-19-related shutdowns. Was told the city of Monticello may plan a story walk on the courthouse square, and heard from Winters that 60 library card renewals were processed in July, more than usual because renewals were paused while the library was closed. Tractor Supply Company Coming to Monticello, by Steve Hoffman, August 11th. The Monticello building that most recently housed a Shopko hometown will become a Tractor Supply Company store later this year. City of Monticello Community Development Director Callie Jo McFarland said the national retailer is scheduled to open in Monticello on November 7th. Tractor Supply Company is a retailer that carries a variety of products for home improvement, agriculture, lawn and garden maintenance, livestock, equine, and pet care. It currently has 1,881 stores in 49 states. Monticello's Shopko closed in May of 2019, part of a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filed by its parent company, Specialty Retail Shops Holding Corp., along with 12 of its subsidiaries. McFarland felt it was just a matter of time before a new business was found for the location at 200 West Burnside Drive on the south side of Monticello. The time it took to fill certainly wasn't because of a lack of interest, she said. Our challenge was the holding company which owned the property. The price was higher than the market supported, and while we sent many leads for them to consider, the price was the main sticking point. Tractor Supply Company will be signing a long-term lease, said McFarland. Other TSC locations include stores in Clinton, located in a former Walmart building, Bloomington, and Danville. Retreat Center open again for small gatherings, August 11th. For the first time since March, Allerton Park and Retreat Center is open for private event rentals and lodging. Reservation can be made by phone, 217-333-3287, for events smaller than 50 guests and overnight stays in the mansion or one of the guest houses, located at 515 Old Timber Road, Monticello. Increased safety protocols will follow recommendations provided by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and require masks to be worn in all common areas unless guests are seated. Additional precautions include closing some areas to prevent congregating, contactless methods for check-in and out, and increased cleaning and disinfecting. Our focus was on finding a way to reopen hotel and event activities in a safe way, said Gordon Zeck, Retreat Center manager. We hope Allerton can be a peaceful place for people to get away and find respite, relaxation, and inspiration during this challenging time. In addition to the virtual events that have been offered over the last 5 months, a limited number of Allerton-hosted on-site events have been scheduled, including third Saturday garden tours, hikes, and outdoor yoga. We're still working to continue to find engaging online content for those who can't visit the park in person, explained Zeck. Amid all the challenges and bad news, it has been encouraging to see an increased number of visitors this spring and summer, people wandering outside and enjoying Allerton on their own. SEC noted that both indoor and outdoor spaces are ideal for smaller weddings, conferences, and events. Even before the pandemic, the community utilized Allerton for outdoor ceremonies, intimate dinner receptions, and small team building retreats, said Zek. While we certainly miss hosting large celebrations, we feel lucky that our space lends itself so well to so many different uses. For more information, visit allerton.illinois.edu, email allertonevents@illinois.edu, or call 217-333-3287. About Allerton. Built as a private residence by artist and philanthropist Robert Allerton in 1900, Allerton Park and Retreat Center is a historical treasure that was donated to the University of Illinois in 1946. The property contains 1,500 acres of woodland and prairie areas, a mansion and reflecting pond, a 10-acre meadow, formal sculpture gardens, hiking trails, a cafe, and several lodging facilities. For more information and to view other events, visit allerton.illinois.edu or call 217-333-3287. Obituaries. Jean E. Price, 97, of Bement, passed away on Sunday, August 9th, at her residence. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the family is graciously abiding with the suggestions set forth. Public graveside services were at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, August 12th, in the Bement Township Cemetery. Harold Michael Swartz, 72, of Cisco, passed away August 6th at Decatur Memorial Hospital, Decatur. No services are planned at this time. Memorials may be directed to the Harold Michael Swartz Memorial Fund. Supreme Court moves Bailey's lawsuit to Sangamon County by Rebecca Ansel, Capital News, Illinois, August 12th. Springfield. Illinois' highest court on Tuesday moved Representative Darren Bailey's ongoing lawsuit to Sangamon County, effectively ending a Clay County court's role in the case regarding the limits of Governor J.B. Pritzker's authority to respond to the novel coronavirus pandemic. Bailey, a Republican from Xenia, asked Circuit Court Judge Michael McHaney to hold the governor in jail until he repealed orders allowing K-12 schools to hold in-person classes, permitting the Department of Corrections to accept inmate transfers from county jails, and reinstating almost 30 previously announced decrees. A hearing that was scheduled for Friday, August 14th in Clay County would have required Pritzker to appear in court with representatives from the Attorney General's office as well as Bailey's lawyer. In an order issued Tuesday morning, the Supreme Court effectively halted that hearing when it ruled no further proceedings could be held in Bailey's lawsuit until it decided whether to take control of the case. Hours later, the court also ordered the lawsuit be moved to a circuit court in Sangamon County to be combined with related cases that are pending there. The justice's decision only partially fulfilled a request the Attorney General's office made Monday. The state wanted the Supreme Court to halt the contempt hearing in Clay County and take over the case from McHaney. As stated in our emergency motion for supervisory relief, there is no legal basis for the governor to be held in contempt for his efforts to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, a spokesperson for the Attorney General's office said in an email. We are pleased the Supreme Court granted our request to stay that issue so that it does not continue to serve as an unnecessary distraction from the important matter at hand. Thomas DeVore, Bailey's attorney, is arguing 5 other civil cases consolidated by the Supreme Court on Wednesday, all challenging aspects of Pritzker's authority to manage the novel coronavirus pandemic. Bailey's lawsuit now joins cases originally based in Edgar, Clinton, Richland, and Sangamon counties, all alleging a disaster as defined by statute did not exist there, and the governor's orders should not apply. Another filed by DeVore on behalf of his children argued high school sports should continue despite Pritzker's restrictions. McHaney, on July 2nd, nullified all of Pritzker's executive orders related to the novel coronavirus pandemic made after April 8th, the date his first disaster proclamation expired. The judge also decided that the Illinois Department of Public Health, not the governor, has the supreme authority to close businesses and restrict residents' activities in a public health emergency. DeVore argued that by issuing additional decrees after that order, Pritzker performed contemptuous acts which are calculated to embarrass, hinder, or obstruct this honorable court in its administration of justice and are expressly calculated to derogate from its authority or dignity. The Attorney General's office asserted in a document that McHaney's ruling is not legally binding. An unenforceable order cannot serve as the basis for contempt. The judge never compelled Pritzker to do or avoid any actions, it added. Officials additionally characterized Bailey's request to force the governor to rescind his executive orders as obviously frivolous. In its memo asking the Supreme Court to get involved, the state also suggested that due to McHaney's prior statements and actions while presiding over the representative's lawsuit, he was likely to handle Friday's hearing with the same willingness to violate critical procedural safeguards, and will not afford the governor all of the protections to which he is entitled. The document contained several criticisms of the judge's actions. In one paragraph, the Attorney General's office wrote McHaney has shown an open hostility to the governor, his emergency actions, and the existence of the COVID-19 pandemic itself. It quotes the judge as portraying Pritzker's actions to manage the public health crisis as tyrannical. The last time this happened, a bunch of guys got on a boat and threw tea in Boston Harbor, McHaney said at a court hearing. Officials also accused the judge of purposely not ruling on one of the last issues in the case in order to prevent the state from appealing his decision. They wrote, his July 2nd order is based on an argument riddled with procedural and substantive defects, and asserted he failed to announce any written or oral reasoning to justify his decision. The Supreme Court should get involved in this case, the state argued in the document, to resolve this dispute and put an end to the public confusion wrought by tactics used by both McHaney and Bailey. Instead of doing so, the justices move the case into a new judge's courtroom. We appreciate the court's decision to transfer and consolidate this case with nearly identical cases currently pending in Sangamon County, where we will continue to defend the governor's authority to protect Illinois residents, a spokesperson for the General Attorney's Office said. AG's office maintains Pritzker acted within the scope of his authority. Bailey disagrees. Pritzker had authority to issue successive 30-day disaster proclamations because the Emergency Management Agency Act, which the governor cites as the source of his emergency powers, does not cap the number of proclamations a governor can issue for the same disaster, the Attorney General's office argued. It cites instances when former governors Patrick Quinn and Bruce Rauner issued multiple orders reacting to the H1N1 virus and flooding, respectively. A governor's ability to do so allows them to protect the health and lives of Illinoisans, according to a court document. DeVore, in written arguments and interviews with Capital News Illinois, has said the IEMA Act does not expressly permit the state's top executive to issue more than one proclamation to manage a disaster. That would be an unconstitutional delegation of power from one branch of government to another, he has argued. McHaney, in July, characterized that as something that would occur in Russia or China or Cuba or Argentina or some banana republic, where after disarming the general population, the person usually winds up being in charge is the one with the most guns and the least humanity, according to a court document. The state pointed out the Clay County judge appears to be the only one in Illinois who holds that position. In almost all of more than 10 cases also brought by DeVore, as well as in other lawsuits, judges upheld Pritzker's response to the novel coronavirus as legal. In those other instances, DeBoer argued, judges only ruled whether a temporary action was necessary while the merits of the case were decided. Therefore, they did not rule on the underlying question of whether Pritzker exceeded his statutory and constitutional authority. The governor was and remains able to file a petition for a higher court to review McCaney's ruling on some of the issues in the lawsuit, DeBoer added. In email conversations with the Attorney General's office, he was informed the state would be doing so by August 7th. It never did. Mr. Pritzker wants to blame me for him not being able to appeal the judge's order, DeBoer said. He made a tactical decision not to ask for that. To blame anybody but himself for never being able to appeal for the better part of 6 weeks is 100% the governor's doing. The governor's spokesperson, in an email, rebutted that. Anything Mr. DeBoer might say about how this case could be appealed is completely disingenuous, given his repeated and ongoing tactics to prevent an appeal, the governor's spokesperson said. Mr. DeBoer has taken every step to avoid an appeal. Those efforts speak volumes, she added. Publicly, DeBoer insists that he is right. Behind the scenes, he's clearly deeply afraid of an appellate court ruling. Cisco Fire nets federal grant, August 11th. U.S. Representative Rodney Davis, Republican of Taylorville, has announced the U.S. Department of Homeland Security's DHS Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in cooperation with the U.S. Fire Administration, USFA, has awarded assistance to firefighters, AFG, grants totaling $442,759.48 to four fire departments in Illinois' 13th Congressional District. Included is a $2,380.95 grant for the Cisco Fire Protection District. The grants will be used to purchase items such as self-contained breathing apparatus, SCBA, and rapid intervention team, RIT PACS, amongst other things depending on the department. Others receiving grants: Decatur Fire Department, $271,090.91. Godfrey Fire Protection District, $168,400. Taylorville Fire Department, $887.62. I'm proud to support these grants in Congress because they're critical to helping our fire departments protect themselves and the citizens they serve. This is especially true amongst the coronavirus pandemic. Taxpayers in these communities pay into the system, and it's important they see the benefits, said Davis. This is an incredible bonus for the district, since approximately 95% of our funding comes from property taxes and the rest from grants and donations, making capital purchases such as this difficult. It is programs such as this that make a tremendous impact on departments by allowing them to make such purchases, which in turn contributes to the safety of the firefighters and citizens. This award will help the GFPD provide the best service we can to the citizens of Godfrey and the safety of our firefighters for many years to come, said Chief Eric Cranmer, Godfrey Fire Protection District. Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for this week. This has been Paula Kaufman with the Journal Republican, reading stories dated August 6th through August 12th, 2020. Please stay well. I look forward to reading with you again soon.